Glory to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit. Amen. Illumine our hearts, O Master, who lovest mankind with the pure light of the divine knowledge, and open our eyes, the eye of our mind, to the understanding of thy gospel teachings. Implant in us also fear of thy blessed commandments, so that trampling down all carnal desires, we may enter upon a spiritual manner of living, both thinking and doing such things that are well pleasing unto thee. For thou art the illumination of our souls and of our bodies, O Christ our God, and unto thee we ascribe glory. Together with thy unregenerate Father, and all thy good and light and spirit, now and ever, in the ages of ages.
Amen. I'm so glad to see so many people here for our second lecture in the Orthodox Survival Series. These are important lectures, and today's is the first half of two lectures that I'll be giving. We have today's and next week's, which talks about virtue and modern society. But today's is entitled Progress and Purpose in Modern Society. There is a lot to cover. If I had it my way, don't worry, I don't have it my way, but if I had it my way, we'd be here for about 4 to 5 hours because there's so much to it. But unfortunately, you can't take away the introductory stuff. So there will be a lot of introductory stuff, and then we get to the meat. And the meat just continues next week. There's a lot of stuff to cover. I'm going to try to go through the essentials. Father mentioned that there have been dozens and dozens of hours put into these. It's not that we decided to do the series and I just started working on it dozens and dozens of hours, but rather these are kind of the culmination of years and years of research and reading and studying, and then being told, okay, now distill all of that into an hour. And that's a really tough thing to do. It's almost impossible, but we're going to do our best to do it. So, Progress and Purpose in Modern Society. Kind of a vague title, but let me explain the goal to you of what we're trying to do today. Last week, Father Justin described a lot about the insanity that we see in the world around us, just how crazy the world is becoming, and it's getting worse by the minute. It just keeps getting worse and worse. So this week and next week, we're going to look at the question of why. Why does that insanity exist? Where does it come from? What's kind of behind all of this? And that's a tough question to answer, which is why we're going to spend 2 full hours talking about it, and we're really just going to scratch the surface. But I want to give you a lot of meat to try to describe to you so you begin to understand why the world is the way it is. Now, there's the simple answer. We've forgotten God. And really, that gets the root of everything. But what does that mean? What does that mean on a practical level? Why is it that forgetting God leads us to this, to riots and overturning police cars and threatening the priests and parishioners as they walk by the parish because they were standing there? Why does all of this result? We're going to talk about that today. Now, before we get into that, I want to explain that we were going to have this lecture downstairs because I was going to have a PowerPoint presentation and I was going to show you some videos. We nixed that yesterday. And we nixed that because you can all thank Pam for that and really thank her for it. Because there was one video in particular that I wanted to show, and it's pretty horrific. It's a music video of a song that actually hit number one on the Billboard charts. The lyrics are horrifically disgusting. I mean, absolutely disgusting. Make you want to throw up disgusting. The video itself is pornographic. And so what I did is I edited this video so that there was a black... It wasn't even a bar. It had to be a gigantic box over everything that you weren't supposed to watch. But after watching the edited version and really just cutting it short, I only had about 40 seconds of the so-called song. I really don't consider it music. I had about 40 seconds of it, but it just still made me really uncomfortable. There was something about it that I just didn't like. And so I thought, well, I've been sitting here editing this thing and just being disgusted the whole way along. Let me get new eyes on it. And I'm sure Pam doesn't sit at home all day watching YouTube so she can watch all the latest new music videos. So this will be new to her, I'm guessing. And so she watched it. And she went, yuck. She said, even the edited version, just the facial expressions and all the different things going on. She goes, there's something that makes me so uncomfortable. I said, I wouldn't even let my kids watch the edited version. And so we decided just to nix it altogether. But I will tell you that after I watch this, I won't tell you what song it is. I don't want you looking it up. I won't tell you who the artists are. Artists, air quotes. But I'll tell you that my comment to Pam afterwards was, in a sane age, you would show this to society, and society would say, my goodness, those two people need to be in a mental institution. There's something seriously wrong with them. But what do we do today? We not only shoot a music video, we make their song number one and we give them millions of dollars. To corrupt us. And the video is very colorful, and it's very clear that it's aimed not just at adults, but at children. It's aimed at children. It's hard to believe. I showed my wife some of it. Because every now and then she gets a little tough on herself and says, I don't know if I'm really fit to homeschool, and maybe our kids need to go to public school. If your kids need to go to public school, they need to go to public school. I'm not hitting you for that. But I will tell you, you need to be very vigilant, because I said to her, these are the videos that their friends would be watching. This would be normal for their friends. And that type of stuff gets in really easily. It becomes part of their conversations. It becomes part of their kind of daily ethos. We have to watch out for these things. So I didn't show that video. There were three other videos I was going to show. One was an Old Navy commercial. Old Navy clothing. And what was featured in the commercial? Equal rights for women, which isn't about equal rights. It's about pushing the horrifically destructive sexual revolution. Gay pride parade, flag, and Black Lives Matter. In an Old Navy commercial, a clothing commercial. Then I was going to show you a 8-minute and I think 46-second commercial on Nickelodeon. What could possibly be advertised for over 8 minutes and about 46 seconds? It was a black screen with a slowly weakening breath in and out, with the words flashing again and again on the screen, I can't breathe. It's being pushed on Nickelodeon for children, so they could know what a terrible racist country they're in and all this different junk. Of course, that was put on before they released the full video. I don't know if you've seen that the full video now, the police video was actually put out. And the reason that they weren't listening when the man said, I can't breathe, is because he had been saying it ever since the very start of the arrest. When he was walking around, he didn't even have cuffs on him yet, and he was saying, I can't breathe. And so it was like the boy who cried wolf. They just didn't listen. They thought, this guy's been saying it now for the whole... And they were very kind to him. The police officers were very kind. They put him in the police car. He said, no, I'm claustrophobic, even though they first got him when he was in his car. And so they took him out, and then he wanted to lay down. I mean, the whole thing was just ridiculous. Nickelodeon, kids, they're pushing this. And then the final one was going to be a commercial that was also on Nickelodeon. I wouldn't know about any of these except when we went to my mother's house during vacation. We don't have TV. She does. And so I turned it on, and I was like shocked by what I was seeing. One of the commercials was an advertisement for the kid of the year. They're going to make this. They said, please tell us who you think should be the kid of the year. And it's going to be this person's going to be featured on Time Magazine. And of course, what do they show? Kids marching in Black Lives Matter. Kids partaking in social justice, being social justice warriors. And so they're celebrating this and saying, if you want to be the kid of the year, if you want to be lifted up, hoisted up on people's shoulders and shown to the world to be the greatest kid ever, these are the things you need to participate in. You can imagine that the kid of the year is not a child who spends an hour every night in prayer. They wouldn't care about that too much. That kid's not going to get on Time Magazine. They would look at that as pretty useless. So the point of all of this was simply to show you that this is being pushed all over the place, and it's being pushed on kids. Now, why is it important to make that point? To show you that the generations that grow up are the ones where this stuff is already normalized. The depravity, the social justice junk, all this stuff has been normalized so that the kids who grow up, and of course it's being pushed also in schools and universities, it's pushing all the music, movies, and TV shows. I mean, TV shows are crazy about this stuff. It's being pushed in most of the news media. It's become so normalized they can't understand how anyone could disagree with it. It's just the way the world works, according to them. We need to understand that this is what's coming. And it's already coming to the forefront. We're already seeing this. It's all over social media. It's what they constantly take in. They constantly consume this. This kind of culminated this past week. I don't know if you saw this story, but there were a bunch of tweets from some elementary school teachers, or maybe middle school teachers, I forget. And they were decrying the fact that if school is online, there's a big danger to school being online for the teachers. What's the danger? Anybody know? Parents could hear what they're teaching, and we got to find out how to protect ourselves against it. What? What are you talking to? You're teaching my kid, and you need to be protected so that I don't hear you? That's the exact opposite of what we want. We want full disclosure. We want to make sure you're teaching things that you wouldn't be afraid to teach in the first place. But you go to California. California, in kindergarten, They're teaching kindergartners about transgenderism, the LGBT movement, and you are not allowed to opt your child out. They don't even inform the parents anymore about this. Legally, you're not allowed to opt your kid out of these things. So there's an agenda, and this is being pushed. This is absolutely being pushed on us. This is the world we live in. So today, what I want to do is help you to begin to understand the craziness around us. What it's about, why it exists, and what its goals are. Okay? Now, the goals, this is an important place to actually start. Why do we start here? Because by looking at the purpose of a movement and understanding the secular understanding of progress, what they think progress is, we'll be able to compare and contrast that with the Orthodox understanding of purpose and progress. Okay? So why start here? Well, when we understand someone's goal, we begin to understand what they're doing before they even do it. We start to look at this. Once we know what the aim of this craziness is, we can kind of understand why things look the way they do. So as an example, okay, if somebody came up to you and said, you know what, I've decided that I want to be a brain surgeon. That's my goal. I want to be the best brain surgeon in the world. You would know what the next 7 years of their life basically will look like. You're going to understand what schooling they're going to be doing, what they're going to be studying, what they're going to be spending late nights doing. You're going to understand them going through a residency. You'll know basically what they'll be reading, what they'll be thinking about, what some of their struggles will be. Will you fully understand it? No, without going through it yourself. But you'll at least understand, just by them telling you the goal, you'll understand essentially what the next, I think about 7 years probably. Is it more? I don't know. Brain surgeon, 7 years. You'll understand what the next 7 years of their life basically will look like, just by them telling you that one goal. I can give you another example. What if I told you, you know what? I decided that I want to climb Mount Everest. And you can all laugh because you know that I would never do that ever. There's no way. But if I did that, you'd say, okay, well, Father Paul's going to be working out a lot more. He's going to be getting into shape. He's going to be reading and learning about mountain climbing. He's going to be doing a lot of online research, probably watching a lot of videos from people who have climbed Mount Everest. He's going to be buying all the necessary equipment. He's going to be saving a lot of money because it costs a lot of money to climb Mount Everest. I don't know if you knew that, like $10,000 or more to climb Mount Everest. He's going to be doing all these things. You're going to know what I'm going to be spending my time doing, what I'll be thinking about, how I'll be living just simply based on that goal. Okay? So if we understand the goal of the movements we see around us, and then we compare it to the goals we have as Orthodox Christians, we will begin to see that there are irreconcilable differences between the two. So that's what we're discussing today. Okay? What are the roots of the modern malaise? Why are so many of these writers so angry and resentful? Why do they burn down buildings? Why, if they're fighting for black justice, do they burn down black businesses? Where does all of this come from? That's what we're talking about today. So to understand this, we first have to begin with what a worldview is. That's where we're going to start. What is a worldview? I want to read to you just a quick little passage. It's actually the first paragraph of this book. At the end, I'll be recommending a few books to you, and this is one of them. This is from the great economist Thomas Sowell, and it's called A Conflict of Visions. And he begins the book this way. One of the curious things about political opinions is how often the same people line up on opposite sides of different issues. The issues themselves may have no intrinsic connection with each other. They may range from military spending to drug laws to monetary policy to education. Yet the same familiar faces can be found glaring at each other from opposite sides of the political fence again and again. It happens too often to be a coincidence, and it is too uncontrolled to be a plot. A closer look at the arguments on both sides often shows that they are reasoning from fundamentally different premises. These different premises, often implicit, are what provide the consistency behind the repeated opposition of individuals and groups on numerous unrelated issues. They have different visions of how the world works. This is a really good little explanation of what a worldview is. A worldview contains the unspoken, often unexamined premises concerning what you value and how the world works. Everybody has a worldview. Every single one of us has a worldview. We have certain beliefs about how the world works. Especially if you're an Orthodox Christian, you have certain beliefs about God, about man, and their relation. And those views undergird all the opinions you have about everything else. And so I want you to think of it this way. Picture a garden. And in that garden, you have the soil. And then you have different plants shooting up. You have some trees. You have different types of flowers. Some of the flowers are, you know, soft and fragrant and beautiful. Some of them have thorns. Maybe you have some bushes. You have all these different plants. Now, the plants don't seem related to one another. But they're connected, right? And how are they connected? They're part of the same garden, which means they share the same soil. In this case, the soil is our worldview. These are those premises that it's just the way that we assume the world works without even having to think about it. We just assume that this is the way the world works. And from that form all of our opinions. And each one of those plants is another opinion and viewpoint. Now, every now and then, we have what's called cognitive dissonance. And we have a viewpoint that doesn't really match with our worldview. And that's what we would consider a weed. The weed is really sucking the life out of all the other plants. Now, this is often what happens in university classrooms. Somebody goes in, they have a basically, you know, traditional worldview. They hold a Christian worldview. And then the seeds of weeds are started to be planted by all the professors. And as those grow, they suck out the life from the other plants, and the other plants die. And suddenly they have a whole new garden. And that garden is just weeds. That's how worldviews change. Okay? But everybody has this. Everybody has this kind of garden view. Everyone has a worldview. You cannot escape the fact that you have a worldview. Now, when you have a worldview, what causes that plant to be firmly entrenched in that soil? The roots. The roots. And so the more you live out that worldview and the more you see it to be true, or the more you just simply assert it to be true, even if it's not, the deeper those roots grow. And that's why it's really difficult to change someone's opinion. Now, I'm sure all of you have had this experience where somebody on social media like Facebook has an opinion you disagree with, and you tell them why they're wrong, and they say, "My goodness, you're right. I can't believe I've been wrong my whole life. Thank you so much for pointing that." Of course not. You can point out to them the proof that this, what you're saying, is not true, and it doesn't matter. In fact, a lot of times what will happen is people, once you point out, if you prove to them that what they just said is wrong, they'll say, yeah, but, and then what they'll do is they'll point to somebody on your side of the political spectrum and say, yeah, but what about your guy? How come you're upset with me, but you're not upset with your guy? In other words, they want to be distracted from the fact that they're wrong about something and not examine this, because that's too dangerous. We don't want to examine that. And those roots go deeper and deeper. Second book that I want to recommend to you. Really fascinating book. Admittedly, I've not read the whole thing yet. I'm about a third of the way through, but it's been so fascinating. It's called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. It's by this guy, Jonathan Haidt. Really fascinating book. And what he does is he goes into this long explanation and this long investigation into why we believe what we believe. And he uses the starting point of the issue of disgust. It's kind of fascinating, the issue of disgust. You may think that's a pretty narrow topic, but he puts it this way. If you give somebody a scenario that they find repulsive, they're going to try to explain why they find it repulsive. And a lot of people have discussed for decades, where does this come from? Is this social upbringing that makes them not like this? Is this a cultural thing? Or are they using logic? Is it simply a logical thing where they're using logic to explain why they don't like this? Now, everybody uses logic to defend their position or say why they don't like another position. And so we tend to believe that we're really logical people. But when it comes to the issue of disgust, we often can't describe why we don't like it. There's just this guttural reaction. And so he uses this example. You're going to love this example. Family's driving along one day, and they're going in front of some houses, they're going down a neighborhood, and whack! Oops, they hit someone's dog. Dog's dead. And the family comes out of the house and sees their dead dog lying in the street. They go, "Oh my goodness, this is such a tragedy. But at least we have dinner, let's eat it." And then he asked a bunch of people, "Is that right or wrong?" And everyone said, "It's wrong! You can't eat the family dog!" And he said, "Why?" And they were, "Because... And a lot of people had a really tough time. And what he found was that reason often is just trying to justify the place we're already going. We already believe something. We may not know why we believe that, but we're going to use reason actually as a backup to try to justify what we're already saying. And so he uses this image of the rider and the elephant. He says our initial guttural reaction to things is like the elephant. And reason is like the rider. The rider can try to steer the elephant left or right, but the elephant has a mind of its own. It's going to go where it wants to go. And so often reason is just along for the ride. This is why it's so hard to change people's opinions about things. Because to turn that elephant all the way around or to turn it far to the left or the right is a really tough prospect. It's not an easy thing to do. So it's not only difficult to change worldviews, it's very tough. It's very tough for a person simply to understand a worldview that is not their own. Why? Because even in trying to understand it, they're already looking from their own worldview. This is the difficulty. This is the problem. And we can be right about something in the wrong way. An example I like to give of this is, let's say I give you a pair of glasses and the glasses have blue lenses on them. You walk around and everything you see is tinted, is informed by these blue lenses. When you look at something red, it doesn't really look red, it looks more purple because of the blue lenses. Everything is changed because of these lenses, which are your worldview. Now, when you look at the sky and you say that sky is blue, are you correct? Yeah, you're correct, the sky is blue. But are you seeing the sky as it really is? No. So you can be correct about something in your worldview and still be off a little bit because you're looking at it from the wrong perspective. Solzhenitsyn, this great Russian literary genius and intellectual who escaped the gulags in Russia, he describes what it took to change people and to change their opinions about the communist system. He said people could see you knowingly, unjustly arrested in the middle of the night, and your neighbors would look at that, that wouldn't change their mind. They could see the policies put forward by the communist government, and they could see them completely fail, and that wouldn't change their mind. And you could drag them to the gulags and say, look inside, look past the barbed wire, and look what's happening to people, and it wouldn't change their mind. He said it was only when they themselves were captured and put in the gulags that they went, uh-oh, something's not right here. That's how deeply entrenched these things are with us. They're so, so deep within us. So, what are we taught about all these different worldviews? I can have my worldview, you can have your worldview, no big deal. We can agree to disagree. There's really nothing wrong with this. And we're all just going to be one happy family, and it's really worked out for America pretty well, right? Because we're a totally united country. We are so the United States. All the states agree with one another. Everyone agrees about masks and about policies and about international terrorism and about... No. No, there's a divide because there are irreconcilable differences. And so the question becomes, is there a correct worldview? Is there a correct worldview? Of course there is. What's the correct way to view the world? You view it the same as the one who created the world to begin with. The one who created it, who knows all things, will obviously have the correct view of things. And this is why St. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 10, what are we supposed to do? Take every thought captive to obey Christ. Take every thought captive. What he's telling us to do is this difficult process. He's saying if Christ is going this way and you're going this way, you need to just take the reins of that elephant and yank it over. And it's a slow process. It goes little by little, but you need to make sure you're in line with the way that Christ views things. Because the whole world was created through Christ, and therefore Christ has the right worldview about things. Can you imagine if you were like this little god and you decided to create this little world in front of you? You know, and you got this like terrarium and you created these creatures and you created everything inside of it. And you knew exactly how everything was going to work. You knew the future. You knew the past. You had omniscience about everything. I mean, you were ready to go. And then the little creatures you created and said, nope, you've got it wrong. This is the way we understand these things. You'd sit there and say, this is insanity. It's insanity. I'm the one who created you. How could you understand better than me? I'm the one who created you, and you're very limited in the way you view things. So this is what we need to do. We need to recognize when we move against Christ, when we move against the church, we're being insane. This is what the fathers say about insanity, by the way. They say mental insanity, mental illness. There's a specific type of mental illness that afflicts many people in a very physical way, but they say true mental illness is afflicted or afflicts all of us. The only ones who aren't mentally ill are the saints. Because they're the only ones who view the world the proper way. They've obtained the mind of Christ. And this is what the church seeks to do, is to help us to understand the mind of Christ. Now, in the sense of the church, this is not just an intellectual thing. Where is the worldview of the church expressed best in words? Where would you say that is? We could say in the Gospels, obviously. We could say in the Scriptures. But in a nice, short, succinct form, the Creed. The Creed expresses our view of the world. The Creed has the most essential things about our worldview. But here's the problem. I could give you the Creed and you could study it all day and all night for days, weeks, months, years. Would that mean that you have the Christian worldview? No. No, because the Christian worldview is lived. It is a lived reality. We have to live the life of the church. And by living it, suddenly, boom, we begin to think the proper way. You know, Father Justin and I both mentioned to you during the whole COVID thing, when everything was shut down, we were trying to figure out what's the proper response here. What do we do? And we talked to holy figures, priests, nuns, monks, bishops, even lay people, holy people all over the world. And being all over the world, you'd think they'd have very different perspectives. Because the way we responded in America is not necessarily the way that somebody, even somebody else in America, like in a monastery in Texas, will respond. Or that somebody in the country of Georgia will respond. Or Serbia. Or Romania. Or Russia. Or Greece. These are all different places with different responses and different cultures and different ways of looking. Did we get a vastly different viewpoint from different places? No. We basically got the same advice from every person. That's a miracle. And the only way you can explain that is that all the people we talked to had spent their lives living the life of the church, and they had obtained this proper mindset. They obtained the mind of Christ. So they all saw things in the same way, even though they saw things from very different perspectives. So this worldview is lived. It's ecclesial. These are the characteristics of it. It's ecclesial, which means it's found and engendered in the church. It's ascetic, which means it's gained through humility and self-sacrifice. You cannot gain the Christian worldview by asserting yourself. You gain it by crucifying yourself. And it's charitable, which means it's always expressed in pure and selfless love. In all things, it is Christ-centered. Those are the four aspects of the Christian worldview. It's ecclesial, ascetic, charitable, found in love, and based always in Christ. But there's a danger. There's a danger when we lose some of these viewpoints, especially when we lose the humility of it. The danger is that we can take our worldview and make it instead ideological. Having a worldview is something you can't escape. Everybody has a worldview. But being an ideologue is not something that you necessarily have to do, and it's something you want to avoid. So, what is ideology? Ideology is when you take your worldview and you dogmatize it. You dogmatize it. When you dogmatize it, there's no room for pastoral concern. We could dogmatize the faith right now and treat you all exactly as the same person. And we could just slam the canons down on you. And every time you bring a sin in confession, we could say, here's what the canon says. This is what you have to do. This is how many months of no communion, and just go from there. That's dangerous. It's dangerous because now, instead of loving you and trying to give you the proper medicine, we're loving the medicine more. And we're saying, forget how it's being applied. You better just take it. Just take your pill and go. It'd be like if every time somebody had cancer, the doctors only had one treatment. And they said, well, this treatment has worked in the past, so it's going to work for you. And you can't do it. So, ideology is when a worldview is dogmatized. And that means everything becomes black and white. There's right and wrong. I have everything that's right. Anybody that disagrees with me is wrong. Have you seen this on social media, perhaps? Have you seen this with people today? Where, like, you agree on 90% of things, and you go, well, I kind of disagree with you. You disagree with me? What do you mean you disagree with me? And they get all defensive and angry about it. They've gone into ideology. They've pushed into ideology. Number one, the worldview is dogmatized when it becomes ideology. Number two, it becomes always asserted. You always assert ideology. What does this mean? Like we talked about, there's no nuance, but there's also no understanding of others. You don't try to understand the other person's position ever. You don't try to see where they're coming from. You simply assert your viewpoint. And anybody who disagrees needs to be taken out in some way or another. That means either defriending them, blocking them, or You make sure that their phone number and their address gets online so that people can go and protest at their house. Has that happened? Yes, it's happened quite a bit. I don't know if you know that. That happens, especially for people in politics or on TV. It means you tell everybody how horrible they are. It means they're dead to you. You assert it. It is not based in love at all. It is simply forced. Ideology is extremely dangerous. Becoming an ideologue is extremely dangerous. Why? Because the beliefs that you have about the world become more important than the person standing next to you. Have you ever thought about how communism worked? What was the goal of communism? I don't know if you know this, but the goal of Marxism was not to have a tyrannical government. The goal of Marxism was to have no government. And everyone would wake up every day and just decide what they wanted to do with their time. And we were all going to live in this beautiful utopia because human sin just it doesn't exist anymore because we got rid of all the institutions that caused it. But there was an interim period where you need a tyrannical government. And why do you need a tyrannical government? Because before we get to this utopia, we got to kill all the people who disagree with us. Ideology says, my beliefs about how the world should work are more important than the person standing next to me. And if you stand in the way of my ideology, now my ideology is all about love. I want the best things for the world. I want the best thing for everybody. But in order to get the best things, I got to get rid of the worst people, and you disagree with me, therefore you're the worst. We're going to get rid of you. Oh, that's one kind of love, let me tell you. That's an interesting kind of love. Is there a danger for us, by the way? We're going to talk more about this later, but can we make our faith ideological? Oh yeah. Oh yeah. When we're more worried about being right in our orthodoxy than living humbly and with love, we've turned our faith into an ideology. And I will tell you, people have done that during this virus. People who emailed us or talked to us and simply ripped apart every bishop that was doing things the wrong way and told us that we were capitulating, told us that we were hypocrites, told us that we were basically heretics and departing the faith because we weren't doing the things the right way that they thought was right. They've turned it into an ideology. They refuse to see anybody with charity and with love. There's no humility in it. It's an extreme danger. Even the faith can become ideological. We have to avoid that. So I want to talk to you now about mass movements and ideology. This is really the crux of what's happening today. We see these mass movements around us. We see everything happening. I don't know if you know the stats, by the way, on these. Depending on how you count them, you could say anywhere from 7 to 12 people have been killed. About 900 officers, 900 have experienced some sort of casualties. They've had to be hospitalized or receive some sort of medical attention. Do you know what the cost so far of all the riots are? Anybody know what the number is? It's about $600 billion. All over the United States. That's been the cost. For justice, right? For justice. So what is this? What is this all about? One of the books that I don't have with me, I have it on my Kindle, so I can't hold it up for you. It's a fascinating book, though. It was written in the 1950s by a guy who had no formal education, which in my book makes him probably somebody we should listen to. He had a lot of common sense, but no formal education. That's a safe place to be. And he wrote a book after studying a lot. He would just read on his own. He studied a lot of mass movements. His name is Eric Hoffer, and he wrote a book called The True Believer, Thoughts on the Nature of Mass Movements. So I'm going to describe to you some of the elements, the characteristics that he talks about with mass movements. Now, some of what I say, I'm not going to tell you when, it's too complex. I'm going to add in my own things. If you want to find out exactly what he says, feel free to read his book. It's a good book. It's readily available on Kindle. But I'm going to add in some of my own thoughts on this. So he talks about the nature of mass movements, which are almost always based on ideology. Not always. Mass movements aren't always based in ideology. And you can see from the characteristics of the mass movement whether it's ideological or not. It may have a political ideology somewhere behind it, but the movement itself hasn't become ideological until it actually holds up some certain characteristics, and we're going to talk about those. So we're going to go at a steady pace here. I'm going to try, but obviously we can't spend too long on this. There's a lot to go through here. This is where a presentation would have been really useful, just to have them up on slides so you could see them. But just follow the best you can. There's quite a few different characteristics. But I want you to pay really close attention and ask yourself, do these help describe what we see around us? Again, why are things the way they are? Why is this movement going the way it is? Why is this movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, why is it so unconcerned with the things that plague Black Americans more than anything? I don't know if you know this too. Do you know what the number one cause of death is for young Black men in America? Well, I don't know if they include abortion in these stats. What's the next? Yeah, it's not heart disease. It's not cancer. It's homicide. Homicide is the number one explanatory factor in the death of young Black men in America. Are we talking about that? No. Are we talking about the great abortion rates? No. Are we talking about the great plague of fatherlessness? No. Why? Here's some of the characteristics of mass movements, and especially those that have become ideological. Number one, we start when a lot of individuals feel that they lack purpose. They lack intrinsic purpose in life. What happens if you lack intrinsic purpose in life? You look around and you see other people who are successful while you yourself feel like a failure because you don't know what you're living for. If other people are successful, how is it that they're successful when you feel like such a failure? There's only two explanations. Either one, you have failed yourself. We don't like that answer. That means I'm personally responsible. And we don't like personal responsibility. Or number two, their success was ill-gotten. They got their success through unjust means. Do we see that today? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We see a lot of resentment. So we have to find a reason that I haven't found success, and somehow that's going to be somebody else's fault. It's going to be someone else's fault that I'm not successful. If they lack individual purpose, the next characteristic, the movement gives them purpose. They suddenly find life's meaning and purpose in the mass movement. And so this consumes them. It becomes what they think about, what they read about, what they talk to people about, and what they spend their time doing, participating in this movement. I want to be as involved in this movement as possible. Number three, if I find my purpose in this movement, and this is where I find my meaning and my value, what happens when you criticize the movement? By criticizing the movement, you're criticizing them. You are injuring them by criticizing the movement. Do we see this today? Certainly not on social media, right? All the time. Here's some thoughts I have about this movement. How dare you? I refuse to be your friend. You're a horrible person. The world would be better off without you. You may think I'm saying it in a funny way, but these are things people actually say in one way or another. This is why people get so emotional when you criticize movements. When you criticize their ideology, they get so emotionally angry because by criticizing the ideology, by criticizing the movement, you've criticized them. And if you criticize them and show that their purpose isn't right, guess what? Oh, it destroys them. So what do? It's like an animal back into a corner. You fight. And they've learned to fight against anybody who disagrees with them. Number four. These movements do not lack faith. They are not faithless movements. You cannot, whether you like it or not, you cannot escape faith. Because the premises of that worldview are often unprovable. They're just assumptions about how the way the world works. And by making them ideological, they've now become a new religion. You can't question it. This is a religion not like ours. We don't believe in blind faith. That's not what Orthodoxy believes in. For us, we have a clear witness of how, is our faith true? St. Theophan the Recluse answered this for us. He said there's only two ways to find out. Either one, you live the faith so deeply that you have the experience of God that proves it's true to you, or until you get to that point, you base your life on the ones who have, the saints. by reading the life of the saints, this will prove it to you. This is why the modern saints are so important to us. You know, you can sit there and say, oh, I don't believe in miracles. I don't believe in all this different stuff happening. Well, Elder Ephrem died less than a year ago in December of 2019. Everyone who met him can tell you miracle stories. Either this is the greatest conspiracy ever, and everyone lied, and I'm lying when I tell you that his hand was still soft, even 4 days lying in the church. Or the man really lived a miraculous life. It's only two options. If you believe option A, that this is one big conspiracy, guess what you need to believe that? Faith. You can't escape faith. Everyone has faith. And these movements are absolutely based in faith. They're based in a worldview that you can't necessarily prove. You can try to provide a little evidence, but you can't really prove that this is the way it is. We're going to talk more about that next week, by the way, to explain that point a little bit more. What were we at? Number four. Number five. If things are based in faith, and if questioning the movement is to question the person's purpose, and that's why they react with emotion and anger, this means that reason and facts are out the window. The only facts that we like are the ones that already support our viewpoint. We cannot look at facts that don't support them. We need only facts that support us. Anything, and not even facts, by the way, that could be completely false statistics, they could be just assertions. Those are what we'll use, and that's what we're going to place our trust in, that's what we're going to believe. But facts and reason that don't go along the party line, they're out the window. The movement itself is seen as fact and reason. The movement itself is fact for them. This is true. This is just the way the world is. I don't need to explain it to you. There have been those who have argued that, by the way. I forget if it was the Washington Post or is it some magazine. I don't remember what it was, but one of them came out. Oh, I think actually it might have been the Congressional Black Caucus, honestly, that said anybody who questions white privilege, that it exists, they're not even worth having a discussion with. This is just fact. White privilege exists and systemic racism just exists. And you can't question that. It doesn't matter what, if you have facts or reason on your side. It doesn't matter. This is truth. This is fact. And therefore, if somebody questions those things, don't even have a discussion with them. It's literally what they instructed. Literally what they instructed. There are no outside facts to the movement. There are only inside facts. We've insulated ourselves. Next point. What are we up to? Six. Because truth is found in the movement itself and not in facts and reason, these movements tend towards extremism. Because the more fervent I am in my beliefs, and the more willing I am to do crazy things, then the more I must be embodying this truth. So they tend towards extremism. The more extreme somebody is, the more pure their expression of the movement is, and therefore we honor them. We don't try to shut them out. This is one of the big differences. Somebody, I was giving this presentation to a bunch of young adults online recently, and somebody asked, they said, would you look at the civil rights movements in these terms? And I said, no. I said, no. For one thing, they had a clear goal. We're going to talk about goals in a minute. They had a very clear goal. And number two, the extremists weren't applauded. They were pushed to the sidelines. Did people find their whole purpose in the civil rights movement? No, when the legislation was passed, the marches stopped. There was a very clear goal of what they wanted. It was funny, the first day of the protests out here, there were people holding up signs saying that we won't stop until the officers are held accountable. The charges had already been, they'd already been charged. They either didn't know that or didn't care. So the movement didn't have a clear goal, and extremism was absolutely held at the forefront. One of the other things, somebody personally asked me once, they said, well, what about the Tea Party movement? Do you think the Tea Party movement was ideological? I said, I think there were ideologues within it, but was it ideological in the sense that we're talking about? And I gave an example. I had a family member go to one of the Tea Party movements, that would go to one of the rallies, and somebody walked up with a gigantic flag of a swastika and started shouting some racist things. And the people around at first kind of ignored him and just kind of stepped away. But after the guy got louder, they all said, shut up. This isn't what this is about. And he kept going. And so they started arguing with him until it became overwhelming and he left. One of them followed him to his car. Guess what he had all over his car? Leftist bumper stickers. It was all left. The guy was trying to present something for the media, to present the whole thing as racist and bigoted and all this different stuff. He didn't actually believe that stuff. He was just trying to color the movement. But my family member mentioned that this was the reason that she felt very comfortable with that particular rally, is because the people who were extreme who came in were driven out. Did that happen with the rallies that we saw? You know, one of the things that I saw absolutely everywhere at this rally and the subsequent days? Spray painting, signs, even some flags with the sickle and the hammer, the symbol of communism. Now, why we find the swastika repugnant, as we should, but not the sickle and the hammer, is beyond me. After what happened in the 20th century under that banner, this should be one of the most repugnant symbols that we should be disgusted with. But everyone who spray painted these communist and Marxist symbols, everyone who held a sign, I did not see a single person look at them and say, there's no place for this here. And I saw the same thing with people who held up signs that called for the killing of police officers. You may have seen the word ACAB written everywhere. Do you know what ACAB stands for? All cops are not rascals. It begins with a B, rhymes with fasters. All over the place. Absolutely all over the place. And yes, calling for police officers to be murdered. None of these people were driven out. Now, I will tell you, I did see one example, and I actually put a story of it, where things got really rowdy, and they were about to turn violent, and one of the guys actually calmed everybody down and got everyone to go home. It was pretty inspiring. But it stood out. It stood out among many other things that we saw, including police cars being overturned and police department being attacked and things like that. We'll get to questions at the end. So, they tend towards extremism. Okay, next. Why be part of this movement, even if it doesn't have clear goals? I mean, some of the clear goals right now are ridiculous and they're not going to happen, such as abolish all police. Come on. So why be part of it? Well, again, I felt like a failure. I saw people successful around me. I'm not successful. I'm finding meaning and purpose in here. And this movement gives me power. I have power in this movement. This is really important because it explains something that a lot of people just couldn't figure out. A man who aimed a taser at an officer's face was shot and killed outside of a Wendy's. And so what was the result? Burn down the Wendy's. How does burning down the Wendy's help the movement at all? Nothing. It doesn't. But it's an expression of power. I can burn down this Wendy's restaurant and you can't do anything about it. Because in this movement, I have power. It's very much this ideological us versus them mentality, black and white. Again, we need to be cautious about this, even in our faith. We can't have that same mentality. We can't have this us versus them mentality. You know, you notice that even during the times of great persecution, Roman Empire with the pagans, even in communist Russia, there wasn't this constant us versus them mentality. One of the places that I read about this recently that I thought was most fascinating was when I was reading that book about Valerio Gefenko, the saint of the prisons. In that, and in Richard Wurmbrand's book, Tortured for Christ, they talked about, especially in the Saint of the Prisons, how there were those who were part of this movement called the Legionnaire Movement, who were very militantly against communism. And they thought it was their job just to fight against communism, and just push against these communists, and tell everybody how horrible they are, and fight them at every turn. And a lot of times, they would soften while in prison, and say, we want to be part of the other faction. The other faction said, this is terrible, but this is where we are. We need to use this for our benefit, and go pray. And they use it to go deeper in the spiritual life. One side viewed it ideologically, the other side didn't. And they came to even love those who tortured them. They're the ones who came out of the prison better off rather than worse. So there's a tendency towards extremism and a sense of power. Last point. You mix all this together. It's ideologically driven, It's against reason. You feel personally attacked when somebody brings up a point against you, and a need to express power. From an Orthodox standpoint, what is this? It's the creation of and the expression of the passions. This is what these movements do to people on an individual basis. It helps engender the passions within them and helps them express them more, and they start to self-identify with their passions. Now, forget the Black Lives Matter movement. Do we see people self-identifying with passions around us today? Oh, yes. I'm attracted to men, and that's not just something that I have in me. It's who I am. And if you disagree with it, you're attacking me, because it's who I am. Now notice, I said we were going to get to this. Notice that within these, there are no discernible, practical, and openly declared goals necessarily. A mass movement can have those, but usually they don't. In mass movements that are ideological in nature, they rarely tell you what they actually believe and what they actually want. And most of the people marching, dare I say, don't even know. And I talked to some of the protesters. When we had conversations, I found out many of them weren't really sure what this was all about. They just felt this was them being anti-racist, and they thought that was a good enough reason. I talked to one girl who, a poor girl, got stuck in it, and I asked her, I said, when things got violent, did you question some of this? And she sighed, and she goes, you know, I did. I started to wonder what this was really about, because it didn't seem like it was against racism anymore. It seemed like it was about destruction. It's about power. So it's very rare that there are clear goals set out. And a lot of times what will happen is these goals, the end goal comes about gradually. So these movements tend towards the most extreme elements little by little, meaning that what's acceptable today may not be acceptable tomorrow. And what's not acceptable today may be acceptable tomorrow. As a great example of this, look at the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. A lot of the people who were part of the Bolshevik Revolution and led it eventually were turned against by others in power, and they themselves were put in the gulags and killed. I don't know if you know the whole history there, but there was a big debate between this guy named Trotsky and Lenin, and they thought that Trotsky was the guy until Lenin finally took power and said, nope, his way is the wrong way. He's not purist, he's not part of the real movement, and therefore we need to get rid of him. That happens all the time. If you watched that movie, Torture for Christ, you saw that happen at the very beginning, right? What's the big meeting that they're having? A bunch of religious leaders are talking about how, of course, the Marxists are going to include us, and it's going to be a Christian movement at its core. We're all okay here, and that's how it starts. You're all going to be okay. I know people who are part of this movement. They say, well, I'm a Christian. No one's ever said anything against me. They have no problem with me being a Christian. Yeah, for now, because they're using you. But as soon as your usefulness is gone, you're gone. They cut you off. And in most cases, they imprison you or kill you. These are what these mass movements tend towards, because they tend towards extremism. We see this all the time, by the way. We see this all the time. What's acceptable to say today is not acceptable to say tomorrow. Besides, the other example I've given you is the LGBT movement, besides the BLM movement. Look at how this has gone over the past few decades. Okay? Look at how it just continually changes. What did they start with? First it was, we don't need your acceptance. That's not what we're asking. We're just asking for your tolerance. That's all. We just want your tolerance. We don't want your acceptance. Then, well, we actually want your acceptance. But it's not like we're going to legislate gay marriage or anything. Then, well, we demand marriage. We demand marriage, but don't worry, this won't affect you. Us getting married, it has no effect on you whatsoever. Then, we demand acceptance of our marriage, and we will flaunt the movement in your faces. And then, not only will we flaunt it, but we want to teach your children our ideology in kindergarten, as we talked about, and not inform you about it, not allow you to opt your child out. This is necessary for the movement. Then, if you disagree with our movement, and you do it in any official way, we will seek to shut down anyone who runs a business who's not in line with our values. We'll shut you down. We will harm your family, and that'll be for the good of the movement, right? To harm you and to harm your family. Then, It became, well, actually, not only that, but we're going to punish and maybe even expel students for hate speech if they don't accept our ever-changing ideological status. If they say they're against gay marriage, that's hate speech, and we can kick them out of the school. Yes, that's happened. And now we claim that, remember, it started off with, we don't want your acceptance, we just want your tolerance. What is it today? Well, gender and sex are not the same thing. There's an infinite number of genders and pronouns, so you better ask, before you get in a conversation, I hope all of you do this, when you meet somebody new, you say, oh, before we continue, what's your pronouns? You need to ask what their pronouns are, because it might not be he or she, it might be ze, zem, it might be all sorts of things that they could make up. Gender could be fluid, which means that I could wake up one day and say I'm a guy, and the next day I'm say I'm a girl, and then the next day I'm say I'm two-spirit, which is a thing, or I'm all sorts of different things. Not only that, but do you know this? If you are a man who likes women, but you refuse to date somebody who claims to be a woman, even though they have male anatomy, you're transphobic, and you're part of the problem. Did you know that? That's right. Not only that, but kids, if they one day decide that they're a different gender than they actually are, then they should be able to receive untested hormonal therapy that permanently alters their bodies because they're a little confused. And if you question that, we're going to lie to you about the scientific results of those things. I've talked to some of the best endocrinologists in the country, and they will tell you, we have no idea what the long-term effects of these are. Movement won't tell you that. We'll also create studies that say that these people are so happy and the suicide rate is not high at all. And those studies are a bunch of bunk. They're a bunch of baloney. I've looked into every one of them. They're a bunch of baloney. Furthermore, we're going to tell you that the Western nuclear family is oppressive. It's an oppressive structure of white privilege. And we seek to destroy it. And we're going to tell you that you are the problem if you don't accept everything that we just said. So much so that it's culturally acceptable for people to try to harm you by making you lose your job or even to physically assault you if you disagree with the movement. Remember, the movement started with, we just want tolerance, not acceptance. And that's where it is today. Bottom line of this, what's the point of this section? The movement, when it comes to ideologically driven mass movements, the movement is not in your control. It's not in your control. Which is why if you meet somebody who's part of this movement and say, well, this isn't what it's like. Come on. None of my friends believe this. We go to these meetings all the time. We plan out these things. None of us actually believes this stuff. It doesn't matter. It's not in your control. The extremist elements will win out. And they're going to push things further and further and further. This is the nature of these mass movements. This means that things are changing very quickly all the time. And we see that around us. I mean, things aren't consistent from one day to the next. It's just constantly changing, constantly. Now, Father Justin's going to talk a lot about Christian purpose. He talked a little bit about it last week. In lecture 4, he's going to talk a lot more about that. But at its root, an Orthodox Christian purpose seeks to change us without forcing other people. Ideologically driven mass movements seek to change society forcibly. It's not about changing us for the better. It's saying that there's something wrong with society, there's something wrong with the structures of civilization, and those need to be changed or destroyed, because that's the only way forward, even if it's against your will. And if you stand in the way, then we will destroy you too. Are we seeing that today? Absolutely. We're absolutely seeing that today. So, Father Justin's talked a lot about this. The Black Lives Matter movement, whether you like me saying it or not, it is absolutely anti-Christian. To the point that rioters have torn down Catholic statues, they've burned Bibles, and they promoted Marxism, which is historically more murderous of Christians than even Roman paganism was, without a peep of resistance from their leadership. Not a peep of resistance. Not a single major statement saying, stop tearing down those statues, stop burning Bibles, stop promoting Marxism. Rather, they say, we're based in Marxism when we like that. You cannot add sin to sin and expect peace or justice to result. Is this to say that the mass movement is addressing something that doesn't exist? No, it may exist. Now, in the case of Black Lives Matter, I think a lot of what they're addressing really doesn't exist the way they say it does. And I could show you statistics to prove it to you. But it wouldn't matter to them. But if there is injustice in the world, you do not fight it by adding sin to sin and expect that peace will result. That will never work. It doesn't happen. It's like taking a dirty toilet and finding a cow chip, you know, a dried out cow poop on the ground, and saying, I'm going to use this as a sponge to clean my toilet. You going to get it any cleaner? No. It's only going to get worse. You're compounding the problem. So what do we really need? We need dispassionate discussion, which requires true love of our neighbor. And if we're going to have a dispassionate discussion, what does it mean for us? We ourselves need to be dispassionate. We can't be ideologically driven. We can't get mad every time someone disagrees with us. We have to see the other person first and foremost with love. And the Orthodox Christian approach is really helpful because it says, all these horrible things I've seen around us, it starts with me, it's my fault. St. Seraphim of Sarov says, acquire the spirit of peace and thousands around you will be saved. Maybe these people aren't being converted because I'm not holy. Maybe that's the problem. So we start with ourselves. So again, for the third time I reiterate, Orthodoxy cannot be lived ideologically. It's not about just simple right and wrong. It's not black and white. We don't assert it on other people. We live those quiet, peaceful lives. We stand up for the faith when necessary, but not to change others, rather to stand up for Christ, because we want Christ to stand for us when the judgment comes. So what is progress for the Orthodox Christian as compared to modern society? Modern society looks around and says, look at all these technological advances. Look at all this science. Look at everything we've done. There's a great Southern writer, I don't know if you're familiar with any of his works, Walker Percy. He's often compared to Flannery O'Connor. Walker Percy made this observation once. He said, you know, in the 20th century, we learned more about the human psyche with the advent of psychology and psychiatry. We knew more about the human psyche than ever before. And we learned more about international relations and other cultures and empathy towards those cultures more than ever before, and tolerance, right? We learned more in the sciences, and we learned more in medicine. We have more technology and more medical knowledge than ever before in the history of mankind. And in every category, you can find that we have advanced knowledge. And yet, despite knowing more about the human psyche, we have more mental illness than ever before. Besides knowing more about international relations and other cultures, we had more war and more murders than ever before. Despite knowing more about medicine, we see the rise of cancer exploding all over us and all these other illnesses more than ever before. It seems that the more advanced we become, the worse off we are. Why is that? You know, I was thinking when I was writing all this, can you imagine if St. John Chrysostom could have gotten in a time machine and been transported from the 4th century until today? He just arrived in 2020. Look. Everyone says 2020 is the most horrible. Let's say 2019. And he would have watched the movies we watched and listened to the music we listened to, watched the TV, read the media, see how people act on the streets. Do you think he would have seen us as a society built on progress? I don't think so. I think he would have seen a people that had regressed rather than progressed. I think he would have seen a people who have actually become much more slave to sin than the people of his time were. We're not Luddites, by the way. It's okay that we have cell phones. It's okay that we drive cars. But these things need to help us advance and to be expressions of the virtues. We don't do that. We have a people who are enslaved by their passions, and when they get together for a cause because they feel like they have no meaning, it becomes destructive. And we're told that this is progress. So, we'll end with what I started with. It seems simplistic, yes, to say that we've lost God. But why is the world the way it is? We've lost God. We've forgotten God. That ultimately is at the root of everything that I've talked about tonight. So next week, we're going to continue on with an explanation of why, when we look at the topic of faith and virtues in Orthodoxy as opposed to the modern ethos, we're going to talk about what virtues are when it comes to these mass movements and what the secular idea of virtues are as opposed to Orthodox virtues. It's really important that we understand this because a lot of times these things start to plague us and we don't even realize it. And we don't realize we've taken on a secular view of virtues. This is why it's so important to constantly take in the services of the church like you did tonight, and God. Take in the scriptures, take in the writings and lives of the saints, take in these talks, you know, take in everything you can, because we need to form our mind according to Christ's mind. We need to take every thought captive. We want to have the mind of Christ so we can make sure we really understand what's going on around us. So I know that was a lot. We did it in 1:05. That was pretty good. I was shooting for 1 hour. That was pretty good. Like I said, I had about 4 hours of material that I wanted to say, so I had to cut a lot of stuff out. But we did it. We did it. I know it's a lot. We packed in a lot. I left out a lot. And next week is probably going to be even more packed, honestly. It's going to be more packed. You may want to bring that notebook and pen because there's a lot to follow next week. But I'm hoping you really... I hope right now you can kind of look at the world around us and say, okay, now I'm starting to get it. I may not agree with it, but I can start to understand why it is the way it is. And I can understand why people act the way they do. Why burning down a Wendy's is seen as an appropriate response to a shooting that you believe is unjust. This is why. So I thank you again all for coming.